Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you all for coming to another seminar on French history. My name's Daniel Lee, and I'm chairing today's session. Andrew recently published this book, wonderful book, which is behind us, Terre and Terroir, The Wine Growers of the Languedoc and Modern France, which looks at identity, violence, and culture in the wine-growing communities of southern France as they faced up to decolonization, European integration, and increasing globalization. As we know, Andrew has published extremely widely on a lot of these issues connected to minority nationalism, decolonization, World War II. You recently had an article out in World War II, didn't you? About the aviators.
Yes, resistance and fights. And
exactly. Brilliant. Yeah. Where was that again? That was French.
In Charlotte's special issue. In European Review of History.
Alongside several other wonderful reviews, articles. Alongside being a fantastic researcher, Andrew is obviously, as we all know, one of the most generous and kind-hearted colleagues we have in the field. So it really is wonderful that he's part of our group, actually, and is actually one of the actual leaders and vanguard. I don't think we would meet and be half as active as we are if it wasn't for people like Andrew Smith. So without further ado,
please. You're a brilliant teacher.
I can't comment on that, but I will take your word.
Well, thank you, guys. Very kind, very kind.
Let's all just sit here for the
next
one.
No, let's. thank you very much, Andrew.
Fantastic scholar, wonderful colleague, excellent teacher. And now let's hear the paper.
There you go. Thank you very much, and thank you one and all. I am going to do today rather modern French history seminar, and I'm going to take us into some very contemporary history. So we will go extremely contemporary, but before we start, I should say that I haven't watched today's Game of Thrones, nor have I seen The Avengers, so we don't get quite that contemporary, although, pretty much. As Daniel said, this sort of emerges out of the work that I did for my book, which in turn emerged from my PhD, looking at the CRAV, the Comité Régional d'Action Viticole, or French wine terrorists, put it in lights, as it were. What this chapter does is it's going into a special issue, hopefully, in contemporary European history. This presentation today is based on an article that I'm currently working on. I've been given revisions to do, and so my idea today was to present the revised version that I've done, and to kind of get you guys' opinion on it, see what you think, and kind of to shop it with you. I was going into something that looks at alcohol and culture. It talks a lot about how a different way of understanding political change in the South. So, without any further ado, in January 1984, France took over the presidency of the European Economic Community. In a summit conducted in the Palace of Fontainebleau, as you can see in this wonderful photo there with Margaret Thatcher staring down the lens, President Mitterrand implored his European counterparts to redouble their efforts in securing a unifying treaty which could form the basis of a people's Europe of more effective cooperation. That same year, far from the palace, a sprawling Leclerc supermarket just outside of Carcassonne was torched, raising 3,500 metres squared to the ground at the cost of some 30 million francs. The fires were set with Molotov cocktails thrown by wine growers, furious at further challenges to their livelihood brought about by rhetoric just like Mitterrand's. Here, the grand symbols and lofty ideals of European integration met the earthy, rooted rhetoric of agriculture and peasant identity. Now, these wine growers were part of the Comité Régional d'Action Viticole, or the CRAV, as you hear me call them, representing an armed wing of the Languedoc wine growers syndical movement, with a loose, episodic presence that made itself felt, quote, when the situation was blocked. Formed in 1961 by young veterans of France's Algerian War, they drew their heritage from the Grand Revolt of 1907, in which the entire region of the Languedoc-Roussillon had risen in protest against devastating market downturns and suspicions of fraud. Throughout the 1970s, they undertook small-scale guerrilla attacks against the state's infrastructure in a period of near-open revolt. In February 1983, for example, around 200 vignerons gathered at Béziers station and stopped the Talgo train, which travelled between Barcelona and Geneva. They sprayed it with slogans protesting against the EEC, and they said, and I quote, "It's not by accident we've stopped an international train. It's a message opposing Spanish entry into the common market." Courting regionalist support, they also sprayed the train with the Occitan Cross, as you can see in the middle there. combining a rejection of European expansion with an articulation of regional identity. The CRAV tilted at windmills and resisting attempts by the French government or the EEC to reshape the region. As part of its engagement with the Common Agricultural Policy in the 1980s, France was signed up to a fund called the PAD, Prime d'Arrachage Définitif, which paid wine growers to uproot productive vineyards to reduce overproduction. I'll get into some of this later on, but basically, the bigger the circle, the more vines uprooted. And you can see around Béziers how concentrated that is, as well as a little summary of the air. Hectares. A hectare is about the size of an international rugby pitch. There you go, there's a guide for you. So this PAD paid wine growers to uproot those productive vineyards and reduce overproduction. Wines became less central to the region's employment. And 1984 opened a story about the Languedoc's changing spatial politics, wherein physical changes to the landscape, with around 150,000 hectares of vineyard uprooted across the Languedoc between 1976 and 2000, shook up traditional political loyalties. Yet for all the CRAV failed to halt imports or uprooting programmes, they highlighted a disjuncture of power and agency between the region and a supranational entity like the EEC via the French nation-state, which was always the kind of the audience to their protests. And this trend helps to contextualise the election of a Front National mayor in 2014 in the heart of the traditionally socialist Midi Viticole in Béziers. The CRAV moved from being a messy, if plucky, regional agent with an ability to influence government by accenting change to a sidelined group unable to alter change passed down by impersonal European power brokers. The decline of the wine industry and Béziers' concomitant loss of economic and social status within the region ingrained a sense of decline and neglect in civic politics. And the FN mayor, Robert Ménard, goaded existing cultures of opposition into a broader rejection of the complex, distant and unpalatable language of the central state. Regional discourse from wine protests on the left was reused in service of the local FN campaign, retooling criticism of impersonal power and demonstrating agency with securitised rhetoric and strongman municipal policies. As elsewhere, this FN municipal victory was not simply a cultural backlash against immigration, the left or liberal republican democracy, but instead it was a retrenchment of conservative protectionist values in the face of economic marginalisation, couched in the language of past regional struggles. Against this background, political developments in Béziers were determined by sectoral and demographic change, yet driven by fears that outside pressure was causing identity to be uprooted along with the region's vines. And you can see some cartoons in the regional viticultural press there, including this fairly graphic but quite evocative one on the left. And you can see that up the top there it says Van Espagne and Van Italie, as you have them removing this from the wine grower's heart. Now, in 1984, as I said, many of the pressures facing the wine growers of the Languedoc came to a head. The EEC Dublin Summit, which ran from the 4th to the 11th of December 1984, set limits on agricultural overproduction, including wine, in advance of the accession of Spain and Portugal in 1985. Each member country was assigned a production quota, beyond which wine would be distilled at near production cost. Likewise, an adjustment of the reimbursements for uprooting vines induced many more wine growers to uproot with the promise not to replant. Surplus production owing to mechanisation, productive, often low-quality varietals of grape, and the abundant southern sun all ensured that the Languedoc had long been France's biggest producer of wine by volume, with around 35% of French volume and 5% of global volume in 1975. Declining French wine consumption from 126 litres per year to 63.9 litres per year between 61 and 2001 meant that large volumes of low-quality wine remained unsold every year, requiring emergency distillation, usually funded by subsidy, to clear the market between seasonal harvests. You can see the difficulty. The more wine you have unsold, next time the harvest comes around and more wine gets released, it just backs up and backs up and backs up. The Midi, therefore, was a prime target for making good French international commitments to reduce volume. Over the next three seasons, after 1984, 20,000 hectares would disappear from the Languedoc-Roussillon, in addition to the 34,000 hectares already uprooted between 1976 and 1985. For wine growers firmly rooted in the social fabric of the region, accepting money from government or European technocrats to uproot their vines became associated with the physical uprooting of wine growers in the region, eroding regional and occupational identity alongside the economic potential of the Languedoc. Jean-Vierge Gévigneau-Fontaine, one of the kind of big scholars of the region, described the decisions of Dublin as sounding like, quote, the strains of a funeral march to the Languedocian wine growers. Yet the Krav raged against the dying of the light and targeted European wine imports with a renewed fury. They intercepted trucks and tankers on the 12th and 17th of January in the Aude, seizing 8,000 hectolitres of Italian wine destined for merchants and emptying it into a nearby stream. Attacks and demonstrations, you can see, one of those kind of interception things happening up in the top right, where they literally just stop the truck, attach a hose, and then just spray it all over the place. If they're feeling productive, they'll drive it to the local prefecture and hose that down instead, just to kind of make sure they understand what's going on. Attacks and demonstrations continued over the next few months as high expectations met with frustration. Then, just outside Carcassonne, at 10 p.m. on the 20th of April 1984, around 100 of these wine commandos gathered in the car park of a Leclerc supermarket. They smashed the windows with iron bars and set the supermarket ablaze with a volley of Molotov cocktails. The next morning, as the building still smouldered, politicians and police mobilised to condemn the culprits. Raymond Queza, mayor of Carcassonne since 1983, warned, quote, "After the events this town has witnessed, I'd say the climate of insecurity is a prelude to civil war." The reaction from Edouard Leclerc, you can see him there getting off his private jet, the proprietor of the supermarket chain, was equally damaging. He claimed that in all of their 450 stores around France, 25% of the wine sold came from the department of the Aude, whilst only 0.1% of wine came from outside France. In destroying that Carcassonne store, the Krav had cut off one of the principal distributors of Audouin wine, a fact only exacerbated by the chain's boycott of Audouin wine for a month following the attack. The choice of target and the scale of the damages affected the Krav's credibility as an acceptable interlocutor, and amidst a broader push to modernise the sector, the Krav's core support among regional political elites was undermined. Lawrence McFalls describes their marginalisation in these terms, and I quote, "Abandoned by their party, the winegrowers of the Midi found themselves with a choice. They could rally to the old professional defence movement, which maintained the tired discourse of unity and continued to maintain that an alternative was possible. Or they could stay loyal to the Socialist Party and adapt to their new liberal pro-European policies." Now, for wine growers, these new policies largely meant the poison chalice of uprooting vines, reducing quantity and increasing quality. And that story is really about the Socialist Party's shift towards a more technocratic, depoliticised form of economic policy, which is largely confirmed after its state of grace ended after its first kind of few years in government, and you know that really gets confirmed after about June 1982. Beset by the need to devalue the franc within the European monetary system for the second time, President Mitterrand was presented with two options by March 1983. One, to leave the EMS, the monetary system, and follow protectionist policies. Or two, to commit to Europe and remain within EMS on what domestic critics decried as, quote, narrow, ordo-liberal terms. President Mitterrand, who tended to represent the Socialist Party pro-integrationist wing since 1971, chose to commit to Europe. This pushed the PS into conflict with some traditional supporters, and there was political headway to be made for parties and politicians in the South, all too willing to seek to politicise the failures of this generalised policy shift. Now, during this period of left-wing government, anti-system votes fled to the margins, and the former southern strongholds of the PS and the PS and the PCF, suffered. In the Midi, as Jean Tuzard notes, the politicisation of the margins occurred using, quote, shared symbolic references that balanced sector and region. The 1907 movement, the defence of southern wine growing, Occitanie, and identified external enemies, Italian imports, merchants, technocrats from Brussels, and the government, end quote. Now, the well-established representative body, which had been formed way back in 1907, the Confédération Générale des Vignerons du Midi, the CGVM, had long kind of fed the Krav as a kind of like sister organisation, really, the kind of respectable wing of their extremism, almost. And it was in a bit of a parlous state at this stage, having been weakened by government snubs and an ascendancy of a modernising union called the Fédération Nationale des Syndicats d'Exploitants Agricoles, FNSEA, which largely represented a kind of national body, the type that hadn't really been present in the South. It'd always been local unions, local syndical bodies, local representative bodies, which like spoke for the wine growers. But suddenly, in the mid 1980s, what you had was government patronage of the FNSEA, which across France had tried to drive wine growers into this idea of a modernising agricultural France, one which adopted new methods and signed up to European integration. And so it became a sort of competitor in the region for the legitimacy of this representative role. For more about that, see my book or ask me more questions. Now, the CTVM would be weakened further by the establishment of the National Confédération Paysanne in 1987, especially in the Hérault, which was set up to defend the autonomy of agriculture and promote greater solidarity across the sector. These aims were expressed in a broader national vernacular than had been the localised demands of the CRAV or the CGVM, and they seemed better geared to address power structures beyond the French government. These old, legitimising civil associations, in the Socialist Party, the CGVM, and even in the CRAV, faced a process of disaggregation as their traditional agency was eroded. Radical winegrowers had previously legitimised the system, quote, while constantly decrying its illegitimacy, by calling for state intervention, while also then just forever lamenting the efficacy of that intervention that they've actually called for in the first place. Crossing the line into that unacceptable violence, like the torching of the Leclerc supermarket, robbed these radical winegrowers of this role as an agent of socialisation, even as the landscape of the region ceased to reflect their vision of it. As Jean-Pierre Gévignaux-Fontaine observed, quote, within two generations and less than 50 years, the wine-growing society imploded. Now, the erosion of local syndical structures was set against the increasing national success of the Front National, which, since its inception in 1972, had become less of a marginal group and more of a partisan presence on the political spectrum. If we acknowledge the short-term roots of the CRAV and the social impact of the Algerian War, veterans, etc., and its longer-term roots in the defence of the wine industry and Occitan identity, then it's perhaps interesting to see the way in which this blurred boundaries in a region where resentment of Algeria was never far away, whether for wine imports specifically or North African immigration more broadly. The Front National stood a man called André Troyes, a gun-toting ex-OAS activist with an extreme stance on immigration, to say the least, who seemed to make no effort to appeal to winegrowers in the 1973 elections in Montpellier. And he took just over 4% of the vote. Interestingly, speaking to Pierre Persegue, who chaired a paper I gave on this before, and I'm actually describing much of his childhood during this period, because he grew up in Béziers, he cited André Troyes as the reason that he couldn't ride a bike as a kid, because this man hunted with a machine gun, and so children were warned about his presence.
Can he ride one now?
Who knows? Well, yeah, well, let's find out. Twitter is the best way to find out. When Marie-Claude Pelletier stood in the 1978 legislative elections in the Montpellier-Lodève constituency, she tried addressing wine growers directly, alongside traditional demands to protect family units and halt immigration. Lamenting the economic crisis and exhibiting a whiff of nostalgie, Pelletier identified the two groups most needing defence in the region as wine growers and rapatriés. Adopting regional rhetoric helped, and by 1988, Troyes' vote had doubled to 8% when he stood in Béziers. Now, the European elections of 1984 caused national shocks when the FN gained 11.2% of the vote, and only 2 years later won nearly 10% of the votes in the legislative elections, gradually eroding the established base of the Socialist Party in that region. Now, this isn't to suggest that the FN enjoyed a meteoric rise, nor uninterrupted progress, nor indeed that the PS and the PCF disappeared from the map, as we shall see. There was, however, sort of upheaval in the fundament of this kind of political loyalties, the sediment of the Midi Rouge was somehow sort of disturbed. And there was a significant spike for the Front National around 1986, when President Mitterrand's risky reintroduction of proportional representation for the legislative elections provoked accusations that he was strengthening the Front National despite Jacques Chirac's centre-right coalition. In the Languedoc, some of the Front National success came not where immigration was highest, but predictably in the countryside, where it was slight. Wealthier Appellation growers, usually independent producers, producing quality wines, tended to vote further to the right, as in Pinet in Hérault, where Le Pen got 19.2% of the vote in the 1992 presidential election. Elsewhere, votes came from the expanding suburbs of Béziers and urban centres, where less secure and less attractive employment filled the gaps left by the decline of mass wine growing. It seemed for many that the extreme right offered a potential for dramatic change, previously owned by the left. On the right, Jacques Blanc, of the UMP, gained a majority by relying on the votes of the FN in his election to president of the region, illustrating a different sort of cohabitation in the south that seemed to signal the FN's partial political normalisation. Now, that kind of political blurring that boosted the FN can be seen in the radical regional press, The first issue of the Socialist Occitan Journal, Volume Vieri Alpes, carries an article from a young Robert Ménard, just after an interview with a leading craviste, Michel Romain, calling for action to promote environmental conservation in the face of industrial development. Ménard's own trajectory from the orbit of the left in the 1970s towards the radical right is useful here, as it illustrates how the issues of identity and landscape drew people away from the traditional strongholds of the Midi Rouge, as we shall see. This is also the case for the Echo des Corbières, a bastion of left-wing militancy throughout the 1970s. Yet the Echo du Languedoc, the paper's successor, which began publishing in 1990, signalled a shift. Headed up by Henri Fabre-Colbert, an Occitanist writer with a proud resistance history in the FTP, the relaunched newspaper was much freer in its political loyalties, and each issue carried at the back a forum of ideas, which invited all political parties to come and address its regional readership. I'm going to point out to you, though, many parties are invited. One party seems to respond quite a lot. And this becomes less of a forum of ideas and a voice box of the Front National. And it essentially starts to carry the Front National an awful lot. One of the readers writes in, says they shouldn't be carrying and publishing the views of, quote, a fascist party like that of Le Pen. However, Fabre-Colbert comes back and says that this is no distinction. There is no distinction in the freedom of the press. And the journal defied, quote, an era in which the laws of exclusion have never been more numerous. And so many people then start to say, well, if it is for everyone, why so much Front National? And you can see Fabre-Colbert is quite an interesting guy. He's a very kind of talented cartoonist as well. He also has a kind of secret garden in his former residence. He's died in the early 2000s. But he's got like all these carvings and kind of like statues in his back garden. He's like an Occitanist and like, you know, unusual political figure, I would say, is the kind of... Now, the continuing predominance of the Front National in this journal provides useful material for understanding the construction of the FN's appeal in the Languedoc. One of the journal's most active political correspondents hailing from the Front National was a man called Henri Escortel, a pied-noir resident in Carcassonne since 1962. He was the founder of the Carcassonne section of the FN in 1983 and elected a conseiller régional in March 1992. In his letters to L'Echo, Escortel speaks of wine growers being manipulated by the left, just as the right manipulated northern farmers. Lamenting the profession's parlous state, he offered a tonic, quote, "What the peasants want is to remain proud of their independence and their culture." Local issues were leveraged to support a narrative of betrayal by government, as with the exaggerated outrage when the bulletin du Conseil Général de l'Aude adorned its front page with a perhaps ill-chosen picture of a smiling young man eating a hamburger with a Coca-Cola at hand. "Oudois wine growers, open your eyes," shrieked Escortel. "You were forgotten, despised before 1981, and deceived thereafter. Your dignity demands, especially in the Aude, that this scandalous political class and their accompanying affairs be chased, and that they be held account for their lies and deceptions." His reaction to the magazine cover may have been a little bit overboard, but it illustrated the contours of that flexible narrative of local disaggregation from left-wing political elites that gathered pace in the early 1980s, with the FN beginning to figure more clearly on the political landscape. The shared symbolic references I mentioned of past struggles were capitalised upon by parties keen to politicise the hardship associated with sectoral transformation and national political realignment. Let's go back to this one here. In Béziers, the former wine-growing capital of the Midi Viticole, the effects of uprooting and sectoral change could be seen acutely. Between 1988 and 2007, the Languedoc had grown in population faster than the national average, 1.4% as opposed to 0.6%. Not gangbusters, but, you know, significant nonetheless. And this has been concentrated around the suburban areas of its major cities, as people were drawn into employment created by new technologies, and also along the coast, principally amongst retirees and people looking for a different track and all the rest of it. Béziers as a city, however, saw another trend. As mass wine growing declined, so too did Béziers' status in the region and its population. And uprooting programmes led by the EEC and French government profoundly changed the landscape of the Hérault, especially around Béziers. In 1975, the city had a population of 83,994. And yet, by 1999, it had shrunk to 69,359. That's a loss of nearly 15,000 people. Unemployment in the Languedoc also remained higher than the national average, with the rate in the Hérault rising from 8.1% in 1980 to 13.8% in 1990. That level would continue to remain high, at 12.2% in 2002 and 13.7% in 2012. That's a very high level of unemployment. Now, that economic and demographic transformation created a tangible sense of decline, and Béziers city centre in particular suffered an exodus. Increasingly, families moved to the suburbs, and young people were drawn away by the promise of Montpellier's vibrancy and the development in contrast to Béziers' faded glory. Now, national elections can help contextualise these developing political trends in Languedoc-Roussillon. And between 2010 and 2012, the FN made inroads into smaller communes, more than doubling their vote share in rural communes with up to 500 voters. A declining population and exasperation with a loss of rural identity eroded the base of the left in the countryside, marked especially by changes in those viticultural structures that altered the long-term demographic outlook. The beneficiary of this demographic shift was the suburbs. Yet, the burgeoning suburban populations saw the emergence of what Jean Villard calls a commuter democracy, as voters favoured policies that addressed domestic issues over employment, looking for representation in the suburbs in which they lived and not the cities where they worked. And I quote Jean Villard, local democracy is commuter democracy, against development, against immigration, and where local elites become conservative by dint of events. A lot of the coastal constituencies around Béziers were also more likely to turn to the right, playing to the theme of a property-owning France and the attendant sympathy for a securitised social policy that the right could serve up election after election. These trends of securitisation and conservative property holders privileged the political inheritance of Pujadism, whose programme had historically found quite a lot of sympathy in the Echo. And changes to that regional political compact was kind of underlined by the CRAV and kind of what happened to them in the meantime. Now, in 1992, on the 6th of February 1992, they had a big wine growers demonstration in Béziers. Now, you always have your big demonstration. Everyone turns out, they've got the placards, they do the marching, probably a tractor or two is kind of in the process, just to snarl up the city centre and get everything kind of sorted and visible. And then as the evening moves on, you have the CRAVistes arrive. Suddenly they are the kind of the armed wing of the syndical movement, they call themselves, you know, the brasse armée that's going to like really kind of get to it with the police in that kind of cat and mouse way. Now, this protest, motivated by perceived fraud, quickly escalated after a confrontation between the socialist mayor of Béziers, Alain Barrault, and CRAV member Michel Bataille over the government's muted response to fraud. And 50 or so wine commandos in balaclavas clashed with police, and several CRAV members were seized as police were ordered by the mayor to arrest the masks. These activists seemed increasingly isolated from their base, and in their masks, seemingly increasingly unaccountable. Things worsened over the summer, culminating in a series of bombings of government buildings and a statement from police Colonel Weber that acknowledged that, quote, there was manifestly wine terrorism at work in the Languedoc. After being denounced as violent thugs, the label of terrorists seemed to finish off any credibility the CRAV had retained as a voice of the wine-growing masses, that nevertheless supported an integrative Republican message and engagement with the Socialist Party. When that started to break up, what we end up seeing is something quite difficult, and those dissatisfied with government and angry at their ill fortune were forced to forge new political alliances that lacked that same storied history. National newspapers commented on the disaggregation of Héroté socialism and on the separation of the left from its regional base in the Midi Viticole, a blow to Alain Barrault, which eventually saw him replaced as mayor of Béziers, though I should note that nothing will replace his eyebrows in my heart. In the election of June 1995, the centre-right Raymond Kuderc beat Barrault, denouncing him as, quote, a hostage to the communists on a shared PS-PCF list, while also highlighting his inability to get results for the town and all the rest of that kind of stuff. But the communists had also lost some of their anti-systemic message by participating in the Mulroy government at a national level, but also in municipal elections alongside people like Barrault. Kuderc, and this guy here is a wine grower. He owns a wine. He owns a vineyard himself near Tézin. He can speak to that constituency, and that's, you know, that's his identity: socialist wine grower, mad eyebrows. Got the whole package. Kuderc, standing on a broad centre-right ticket, remained mayor of Béziers from 1995. All the way up to 2014, surviving challenges from the left during that time in Jean-Claude Guizot, a transport minister under Jospin, and the socialist Jean-Michel Duplat, who still is active in BTOA politics in Béziers. In the context of broader political realignment, Kuderc's tenure bridged that transition period as the socialists lost their hold on the region's loyalty. Uprooting had transformed the wine sector, and the outlook remained difficult. And further protests against European integration and the opening up of the wine market took place. In 2000, Jean Houillet spoke of, quote, the seeds of a developing crisis for the cooperative wine growers of the Hérault, and a series of commando actions took place against government office buildings and toll booths. As these protests continued in 2001, syndical leaders led marches and protests, ranging diatribes against the French government and the community regime in Brussels, end quote. 8,000 wine growers blocked the roads in protest, and elected Béziers officials were amongst them. Christian Pelagatti, deputy mayor of Béziers, told reporters, quote, this viticultural crisis, whose effects are beginning to be felt, will have dramatic effects on the local economy of Béziers. Over 7,000 protested along the Allée Paul Riquet, which is the big central street in the middle of Béziers, the big place they have the markets and all that kind of stuff. The Allée become this kind of symbolic thing. It gets decried as being like, never mind, I'll get to it. When Maynard talks about this, it's like, that's the thing that's degraded and somehow been allowed to like neglected, and that's what they need to revamp and all the rest of it. So you got all these wine growers protesting along it. Again, violent clashes with CRS and also commando actions against suppliers. As wine growers' spokesman said, again, quote, since 1907, nothing has changed. Now, signs of the Front National's attempt to appeal to this growing dissatisfaction can be seen in the unsuccessful mayoral campaign run by Francine Lopez-Comanche, who nevertheless courted the wine vote by highlighting injustices and inequality. Quote, wine growers live with 2,700 francs per month, whilst young people drive around in BMWs. Now, concurrently, the Front National gained a dramatic 35% of the vote in the first round of the presidential election in Béziers, with Jean-Marie Le Pen receiving 3,000 more votes than Jacques Chirac in 2002. Now, in municipal elections, however, that rise was somewhat masked by the tradition of broad platform candidates. The FN had done well in 1995, capturing the mayoralties in Toulon, Orange and Marignan, before the party split, denting its progress. After the split, the subsequent appearance of the Mouvement National Républicain in 1999 didn't prove mutually exclusive with the continued existence of the FN, and councillors elected on protest votes cropped up from both parties during Raymond Couderc's mayoralty in Béziers. One of Couderc's greatest supporters was the aforementioned president of the region, Jacques Blanc. And although Couderc skirted direct association with the far right, as mentioned, Blanc had relied on their votes again in 1998 and lent them a bit of an air of respectability on a kind of like national council level. He kind of brought the centre-right into power by saying, OK, we'll kind of listen to the Front National at very least. Now, amidst these political shifts, the wine crisis continued to deepen, changing the region's economic profile and reshaping areas of economic activity. In 2002, just outside of Béziers in Sauvignon, the CRAV targeted supermarkets and destroyed bottles of Greek, just for you, Dion, and Italian wine in what they called quality control. And you can see some of that happening down the bottom there. CRAV, they've written on the wall. You can see this just becomes a spray painting to sign the actions off. The enemies that they named remained the same, and the wine growers remained mobilised. Following an acute sales crisis, a coordinated day of protests across the Languedoc-Roussillon in February 2006 saw big marches again in Narbonne and Béziers, and spokesman Philippe Vergnès demanded the Prime Minister announce immediate support for the region and adopted, quote, extreme rigour in the face of European institutions in order to defend French vineyards. CRAV action, predictably, continued right across the Languedoc, with attacks on supermarkets and tax offices across the Hérault, signalling imports and taxation remain priority targets. Regional protests in 2009 cited the crisis, which had begun in 2004, as the worst the wine growers had ever faced, and up to 10,000 wine growers protested in Montpellier, whilst raucous demonstrations saw an estimated 1,000 police and CRS deployed in Béziers. These repeated protests and their shared targets demonstrated the ways in which the continuing wine crisis was hollowing out that constituency of mass wine growing upon which the policies of the South had long been built. The politics of the South, excuse me. Now, one of the most symbolic indications of that shift, one of the kind of emblems of that big transfer, was the conflict surrounding the takeover of the Béziers-Bougin cooperative by its counterpart in Coursin, across in the Aude, across the departmental boundary. Béziers-Bougin, of course, is right next to Béziers, and it was just this kind of symbol of the cooperative winemakers of the town. Now, it runs into difficulties, and of course, they then start looking for buyers. And someone comes in with a rescue package. But the rescuers are Audois. They are from the department next door. And they say, OK, we are going to save this cave. We're going to save this kind of cooperative winery. We're going to save most of the jobs. But we're going to take the winemaking from Béziers and we're going to centralise it in Coursin. This is going to be where we store the wine. We're going to make the wine over there. Now, for many people, this becomes controversial because it's the last kind of viable cooperative winery in Béziers. And Béziers is often seen as the kind of the birthplace of cooperative winemaking. The Maraussin cooperative in the northwest of Béziers had been opened by Jean Jaurès in 1905. It had the musketeer's motto across the top of the door, you know, one for all and all for one. This idea of kind of cooperative socialism imbued in the heart of the region. And suddenly, Béziers, no more. And so losing control of that was really quite symbolic and a marker of decline as well. Conscious of symbolic loss that's represented, Raymond Couderc and his ally, Ilie Boudy, tried to warn against the move, saying, and I quote, "The relationships will not remain the same between government and wine, and we could no longer consider the wine as being from Béziers. That does not mean that wine is dead in Béziers, however. It remains full of private sellers and small producers." However, despite Couderc's intervention and his protests, the merger went ahead, with the amalgamated winery fully opening its doors in 2014. And this signalled a symbolic shift in the town's prominence as a capital of the Midi Viticole, as well as a personal blow to the mayor's own local reputation. The personal reputation was important as a marker of southern politics, and actually that's something that we can see quite dramatically in terms of the kind of regional examples. In Montpellier, Georges Fresh, of course, had demonstrated the power of a socialist vision of modernising municipal administration, founded on an outspoken personality combined with pragmatism, clientelism, and an ability to speak different languages to different audiences. Another example of that personalised style was the great rival of Fresh, Jacques Blanc, that I mentioned before. Both figures professed a role beyond party structures while clothing themselves in references to the region's heritage. Robert Ménard capitalised on this background of personalised politics in his Biterrois campaign, injecting a populist nativist line into what regional geographers Négrier and Jourdain described as the regional populism of Fraîche and Blanc. When Ménard faced up against Couderc in the municipal elections of 2014, therefore, his was not a candidacy that appeared out of the blue. Rather, it came off the back of a long divorce from the left, allied to a discrediting of the region's agents of socialisation, amongst the syndical organisations of mass wine growing and indeed their militant wings. Béziers' recent political history bred a dissatisfaction with the alliances and electoral platforms that characterised previous mayoral candidacies, and instead highlighted the appeal of a candidate with an anti-systemic message, name recognition and a distinctly different programme. The decline of wine growing had a long systemic effect on the city, but the recent sale of the Béziers-Bouchain cooperative also strengthened the narrative of, quote, the death of wine in Béziers. After the literal death of Georges Fresh, loyalties were split in the region between those who supported different lists sponsored by him or the Socialist Party. And so in the mayoral election of 2014, the centre-right Ilie Aboud was Couderc's nominated successor, who'd managed to rally people to his cause, like the one-time Fresh protégé Agnès Julien. Aboud took Ménard to the second round in a close-run campaign before Ménard won with 47% of the votes. Ménard's personal campaign was a broad church, appealing to those in the FN, Bloc Identitaire, and even those with sympathies for Action Française, while functionally aloof from the existing political machinery and the norms. Ménard's very loose affiliation to Front National thus helped his ability to present himself as a local boy that understood local problems. Of course, local, he was a Pied Noir who was then moved back to Béziers and grew up in Béziers. So he's a local boy in every sense of the word and the grievance as well. The grand protest of 1907 had, however, been a recurring rhetorical feature of regional protest and thus became a particularly useful historical referent for Ménard in his trumpeting of regional heritage. The alliance of many of these ideas behind it, between Occitanism, between regional identity, between professional identity, and all these things, form part of a conscious effort to write the mythology of the wine growers movement, connecting it to a broader regional struggle rooted in ethno-linguistic identity, people speaking Occitan and identifying themselves as part of a civilization of the vine, and kind of identifying a kind of different era, a different vector of patrimony, you might say, or something like that. The decline of the wine growers didn't kill off that myth of 1907, and that rebellious rhetoric appealed to those smarting from the internalisation of decline and that symbolic or material loss. That loss, symbolised in the economic transformation of the region, had greatest potency when articulated in the language of regional revolt. At the start of his campaign in 2013, therefore, Ménard emphasised, quote, true local culture as being one of the central concerns for his Choisi Béziers platform and framed his own narrative of the region's struggles. I quote, from the Cathars to Jean Moulin to the revolt of the wine growers of 1907, Béziers knew how to say no when it was necessary, when history demanded it, when the conscience demanded it, when freedom imposed it. Indeed, in an illustration of the potential for these reactionary regional narratives, Ménard trumpeted his endorsement by Philippe de Villiers, the conservative author and founder of the Puy-du-Fou theme park. Later, Maynard would invite Villiers to promote his most recent books at a free speech-themed series of lectures in Béziers alongside other repeat guests like Eric Zemmour. Now, I say free speech, it's the same three guys invited every year to come and speak and sell the latest book that they're trying to advertise. And an example of how French history could serve contemporary political messages, the Journal de Béziers, which I've been using a lot and you'll see a little bit more of, noted Villiers' book on Joan of Arc told, and I quote, this is their summary, a stunningly contemporary history of a people betrayed by its so-called elites. Now, after being elected, Maynard inaugurated a series of frescoes on the sides of buildings to commemorate Biterrois history. Again, they reference prominent figures like Jean Moulin, as well as a tribute to the revolt of 1907. Marcelin Albert up top, the revolting soldiers of the 17th Regiment, the kind of mutinying soldiers down the bottom here as well. During his campaign, Maynard focused on the urban environment and proposed to strengthen the town's three strengths, energy, wine and tourism. To do this, he proposed the establishment of a Maison des Vins, an historic centre, that could capitalise on wine tourism, as well as erecting signs that declared Béziers world capital of wine. Now, this was part of a, quote, reconnection to the purity of local traditions, like the Feria, a southern celebration of bullfighting, song and regional culture, which Maynard enthusiastically endorsed, and also at which, just by the by, he reintroduced the once traditional mass to open it, which had been done away with in the interest of laïcité. Now, in 2016, when Maynard opened the festival, he played upon this long narrative of a civilization of the vine, rooted in the region and its traditions, like the Feria itself. And you can see him, and he is there, right down the front, with his wife, who is now a deputy for the region as well, worth noting. Quote, I have said it often, this is Béziers, and as you know, the people of Béziers are proud, and they are unbowed. That's going to be interesting. A people who have 1,000 years of resistance behind them, from the Cathars to the wine growers of 1907. A people who are part of a civilization, a Christian civilization, which has been around for 2,000 years and seen off plenty of others. A people who have their own identity and who are holding on to it. When opening the Feria next year in 2017, again he drew on 1907 as a moment of regional pride, celebrating its defiance. Quote, yes, like you, I love the soldiers of 1907, who refused to fire on their brothers, the wine growers. That was exactly 110 years ago, right here in the Allée Paul Riquet. Now, this recurring connection between the region's history and its present, made through allusion to the streets, was an important indication of how Maynard's values found roots in that regional consciousness. These roots appeared strong and were interwoven with Béziers' urban environment. Quote, and again this quoting Maynard, they plunge into our smaller alleys and into our greatest monuments. The atmosphere of Béziers is imbued with this very long history. As such, the months after his election saw a swiftly implemented series of measures designed to crack down on minor crimes in the city centre, citing the defence of patrimony as a driver for reform. Maynard then announced in February 2015 municipal police would be armed and tried to form a garde biterroise before he was told it was unconstitutional and he couldn't raise his own private armies. His administration claimed a mandate, therefore, and I quote from the Journal de Béziers, to reconquer the city centre street by street, shop by shop. Now, this reconquista was designed to dispel a creeping sense of abandon, allowed to develop by what he called defeatist politicians. In office, he continued to oppose the opening of large suburban stores, which contributed, he said, to the destruction of the city centre and constituted economic suicide for the town. And that spoke, really, I think, to the developing relevance of Villars' model of commuter democracy, to Béziers and to its political demographics, balancing changing urban dynamics with securitised politics. And this form of concocted narrative thus played on concerns of uprooting identity, as well as leveraging worries about economic insecurity and powerlessness in the face of external forces. Béziers, as a result of its wine-growing heritage in particular, voted firmly no in both European referendums in 1992 and in 2005, going from 56.2% to 61.7% during that period, and the no votes in both those referendum. This marked an endorsement of a long culture of opposition, as we've seen, and in particular flew in the face of regional elites that in both instances had favoured a yes vote. Jacques Blanc, for example, had successfully created a social imaginary which grounded international issues in local reference to establish, quote, the legitimacy of their spatial definition and at the same time their own right to intervene in defence of specific interests. This allowed a cautious engagement with Europe, in which the Midi could play a greater role, reimagining itself as a European in a European context as opposed to a French national one. However, the popular rejection of that kind of elite message is perhaps best understood in the context of the Talgo train hijacking that I described, and the written protest that we saw in the pages of the Echo de Corbière and Echo de Languedoc described earlier, or, indeed, in the Crave attacks, which continue to target Spanish wine imports, as they did in Béziers in 2016 and 2017. On Friday, 24th of March 2017, the offices of the wine brokerage Verniers et Passerieux were torched with Molotov cocktails, and the offices spray painted once again with the name of the Crave in protest at the import of Spanish wines. The following day, a mass rally in Narbonne. This guy here, who's one of the big kind of like top-thumping kind of Cravistes of the moment, Frédéric Rouanet, who's the Audois wine syndical leader, called on politicians to defend the sector and the region. And I quote, "You can't leave us alone in the face of this profit mania. Was Europe made to protect us or to kill us?" Commenting on a protest, Ménard's mouthpiece, the Journal de Béziers magazine, signalled its support for the wine growers' campaign. Quote, "Béziers, historical capital of wine growing, needs to support its wine growers. Beware, globalisation means plonk. The denunciation of the European Union as distant, technocratic and injurious to national identity had long been FN policy and was enthusiastically endorsed by Marine Le Pen, who again won the first round of the 2017 presidential election in Béziers. For Ménard, ploughing his own furrow, he could in turn lament how, quote, the French political class had officially abdicated in the face of the ravages of globalisation. During Ménard's campaign in 2014, he tapped into this resentment, straining to make clear his opposition to communautarism and also any resultant threat to the inviolability of the Republic, all with coded references to globalist elites and the voice of the putative ordinary Biterrois, as when he referred to Béziers as a city of resistance in his appeal to US President Donald Trump, inviting him to visit the region in 2016. Such resistance was shown by illegally polling the ethnic composition of primary schools, again in direct contravention of the Constitution, or by championing his display of a Christmas nativity scene in the mayoralty, which he does every single year, just to be censured every single year, as a kind of symbol. Importantly, and I haven't focused on it here because my reviewers asked me to cut it this section, he addressed a strong Pied Noir community of which he himself was an active member. In playing up to threats to local culture, he promoted the idea of a grand remplacement, that notion that he freely adopted from the far-right Renaud Camus, who posits the gradual dilution and disappearance of French civilization because of immigration. And this led him to defend, there's a picture of his crèche there, led him to defend Béziers vociferously against the humanitarian impositions of external elites, notably with alarmist posters featuring concocted images of migrants. I'll just show you some of those posters there. You can see this has been switched to say Béziers on the train there. He also shows migrants in front of the local cathedral and all the rest of it, and just these photoshopped images designed to stir up emotion. Railing against these abstract forces like the state, European integration, or indeed globalisation allowed Ménard to appeal directly to securitised commuter democracy of the suburbs whilst maintaining the language of regional difference. This focused on Béziers' relative decline because of changes to the wine sector, just as it played on the trope of a fragile ethno-national identity. As with the wine growers in Europe, Ménard's references to 1907 and his quest for cultural authenticity blended lingering concerns into a much more compelling narrative around that same uprooting of identity. So that process of political and economic realignment after 1984 affected Languedoc profoundly, marking a significant turning point. The structures of viticultural representation changed as the wilder elements of the wine growers' defence movement lost ground to rivals readier to support reform and the agency of traditional representative bodies to negotiate change with bigger, impersonal powers floundered. By 1992, when accusations of wine terrorism were made by police and mass protesters were arrested in Béziers, European integration was significantly altering the economic activity and the physical landscape of the region. Against this backdrop, the development of the FN benefited from a broad group of voters forced to reckon with profound negative change to an industry with a long and proud heritage. Cultures of protest adapted and changed, though they did not disappear. The ability of Robert Ménard to capitalise upon this trend in Béziers was an example about how the growth of a suburban electorate coupled with economic decline could be addressed with those shared symbolic references borrowed from the vineyards only decades earlier, yet shaped for the ear of a new commuter democracy. "Why come back to the past?" Ménard asked at a speech in 2016. And he said, "Because the past flows into the future. Everything comes back." Now, the past to which he was referring wasn't the sectoral change or demographic shift since the 1980s that had contributed to his election, but the platform for a popular Gaucho Le Peniste appeal which bound the resentment of regional hardship to issues of national concern and suffused them with symbols of the past and racist rhetoric, let's be honest. His focus on the urban environment of Béziers appealed to the sense that the city was in decline from its former position as a wine-growing capital, and his tussles with external powers, be they Europe or the French state, were a bid to assert agency. His concocted vision of the long past offered a shortcut around the difficult political realities of the recent past, channeling cultures of opposition which had been stifled and activating insecurities about declining status and future development. Understanding that Leclerc fire and the Dublin Accords as steps on the road to this altered political reality puts the emphasis on how decline of wine production in the region was part of a broader untangling of regional alliances. And it shifts the language of Maynard's victory towards its sectoral and demographic determinants and away from any alarmist notions of cultural backlash or any war of civilizations. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much for that. Maybe I could just get us going with a couple of questions.
Yeah, of course.
So I'm interested. So you said towards the end that the reviewers asked you to cut the Pied-Noir.
Yeah.
Did they tell you why? I'd like to know if you could just say a couple of words about why they wanted you to cut that, because
sure.
Just quite interested.
Yeah.
That's part one.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, thinking more about Algeria broadly, you know, a lot of these people that you mentioned, you hinted at, had these sort of backgrounds, previous lives in colonial Algeria. Mm-hmm. So I'm just a little curious if you could sort of tell us a bit more how they related to the sort of image of Algeria. After independence. And then I guess the last thing I wanted... Do you want to write?
Yeah, I'll go.
And then the last thing I wanted to know was when you talked about the late 90s, this very specific moment when the Front National kind of splits.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the MNR come into fruition.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious if you could say a little bit more about the specificity of that split in the region that you're talking about, because I had a quick look at Google and the big sort of poster you showed us of that guy Henri Escourtel, it seems, split and left the FN.
Yes.
So I'm just curious to see a little bit more about how some of these individuals sort of what directions they go in and whether they later come back.
Yep, absolutely. First of all, yes, I think many of them do split, and that plays into... I'll do this bit first and then do the Algeria bit next. Many of them do split and many of them do move around, and this is one of the things which Maynard is able to play upon, because he sort of accepts the mantle of the FN without ever being an FN guy, like from the machinery of the FN. And he sort of launches his appeal. He's already said that when he runs again in 2020, which he's announced he will, he's not going to take the FN platform. Mm. He feels he's actually got his own legit kind of platform now. He's the guy. So actually what he's able to do is to kind of draw many of those kind of former kind of estranged FN activists to him, because he's already, you know, this kind of weird figure. Of course, this is where you see just last year when he had some great pictures of him and Marion Maréchal Le Pen, because she kind of goes to his big attempt to create a new sort of French like alt-right union, Os Tatouat, and you know, she comes down to see like what's going on. There's this big moment of like kind of you know, Kremlinology on the right. Who's going to, you know, form up, and is this going to be the new kind of like populist, you know, nativist crest of the wave and all that kind of stuff? And she decides eventually that she can't get on board with Ménard's sort of independence of thought, you might say, or as being an arsehole, let's say. Yeah, and there's some wonderful photos of him standing talking and Marion Maréchal Le Pen in the background, like giving him the most evil stares you've ever seen. It's quite a wonderful picture. I should actually try and find it at some point. But yeah, it's part of his Ostratroit. So it's an idea to, he hopes to build bridges to help heal some of the wounds of those splits. And he's very focused on municipal politics. He's kind of not that willing to be drawn by national politics. His wife does that. but she kind of, you know, it's part of this... this very strong commitment to municipal politics and national identity, I think, is the two kind of vectors. Yeah. So he tries to kind of create a broader alliance, I think, for the right. And people, I guess, Cortel, who's dead by that stage, actually, but kind of come back towards, I think, where they are. I think he's dead. Maybe I'm confused.
Who is Escourtel?
Yeah, I think so. Algeria.
Even he, Escortel, it said, né en Alger.
Yeah.
So that's like a thing. Like, they want to show their...
Yeah, absolutely. No, they broadcast it in a big old way. I can show you after, maybe, or something like that. The Journal de Béziers covers Algeria in a big way. One of the things, the reasons the review asked me to cut it is not because of any desire to like occlude it, but they said originally the first draft of the article felt a little bit too much like a kind of game of two halves. I talked a lot about the kind of crève and the disaggregation, and then second half I kind of got really involved in sort of kicking Robert Ménard and saying why all his policies are so racist and all the rest of it. But one of the big things he does is he renames the square, the street, which is named after the date of the Evian Accord, because he says, you know, here we don't celebrate defeats, so instead we want to do something different. And so he renames it after this guy here, Commandant Dinois de Saint-Marc, who he calls a French hero, who's a figure that's involved in the periphery of the OAS. And again, this is a big thing. He talks about the idea that the Arquis and the Pieds Noirs should come to Béziers, should understand their place in the nation, they're important in the nation. You know, that Journal de Béziers talks about, they print all this stuff saying, like, Algeria, our lost paradise, this was our land, our country, they've taken it. You know, that language suffuses it. He's got posters of all the kind of the old veterans, the old Pieds Noirs, all the kind of associated culture is there, kind of trumpeted and kind of played into this part. And Béziers kind of like really has that strong kind of focus on that. So he does really kind of really strongly play on that. And it is a definitely part of his election campaign. One of the things he then does is he tries to kind of target the kind of largely North African areas of the city centre. So he does things that he claims are all about making the city look nicer. But by making them look nicer, they also create what you might call, in this country, a hostile environment for people from North Africa who've migrated to France. In particular, things like hanging your laundry outside on a balcony is banned. When he does the... when he polls primary schools, it's because he says all these primary schools in the centre of town are just like all North African now. You can't see any French. He says, like, you want to see his argument about Grand Remplacement. He says, like, you want evidence? Let's look at a school photo from like 1985, and now let's look at a school photo from 2019. And he says, I put it to you. And then he does his own kind of like unofficial poll and says, like, oh, these schools are like 70%, I'm making up the number now, but, you know, 70% of North African. And he uses this to kind of talk about how shocking it is and all the rest. And of course, this is completely unconstitutional. This is completely like outrageous. This is, you know, part of a kind of concocted narrative, which essentially supports this kind of narrative of a kind of like puffed up importance and puffed up vulnerability of a certain idea of France. You know what I mean? All that kind of ideas. What he plays upon. So yeah, it is a really important section of that, I think. And again, I was just showing you some of that anti-migrant rhetoric. This is another one of these posters. You can see that he puts up. Right in front of the church and all the rest of it. I mean, these are just like clumsy photoshops, but just so many of them appear, and they are, you know, they're offensive. He makes great play of this. You know, he says, like, what my posters offend the kind of the nicey Parisian kind of commentariat in the newspapers. Yeah, whatever. People know what I mean. And it's all this idea. I mean, we know this language. The posters are already out there, so by the time they're censored, it then creates more visibility for them. People see them and all the rest of it, and they buy into that rhetoric. He's done long-standing campaigns. You probably noticed if I scoot way back to that photo of him. He's got a long-standing campaign against the Midi Libre, which is one of the biggest newspapers of the region, where he says, like, well, they print lies. So don't read their stuff. Read the Journal de Béziers, which I bring out twice a month, and which is okay. And it is a sort of a complete mouthpiece. It has all these kind of like editorials. It's got adverts for the local dentist and all that kind of chat as well, you know what I mean? But it's stuff about... and, you know, it's municipal. There are full-page pictures of dog shit because of his campaign against dogs crapping in the street. Like, so it's like full of these kind of, you know, it's that kind of like level of you know, municipal politics combined with grand like narratives railing against the Midi Libre as a kind of lying fake news establishment, and then like the idea of a fragile kind of ethno-national French identity being replaced, and how he's standing up to them. His dream is to make Parisians want to live in Béziers and show them all that. So yeah, there's lots of that kind of stuff that you can see all over the case. Yeah.
Thank you.
No problem.
Thank you. Please, Stu.
I've got a couple of questions. Firstly, you mentioned, a friend had made it down, about somebody integrating this kind of idea of defending the traditional household. which kind of made me wonder, I wonder how far this discourse is gendered, how important is gender in this kind of politics. And the second question I had was around, I suppose, how people define the region, because of course the idea of the region is really, really important, and I was just really, really struck by this idea of winemakers from Béziers getting really, really upset about people from across the departmental border in the Aude taking over their wine work, their wine production, because of course these departmental divisions are kind of invented in the revolutionary period,
yeah,
precisely to divide regional configurations. So it's kind of interesting that they then go on to become kind of locuses for identity. And I suppose in some of what you've just been saying around the kind of importance of municipal politics, and then you had this really interesting one of the cartoons you were showing had the with the kind of the barbed wire going across.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. The Exode.
That one almost looked like the kind of the Maggiolo line, which is a kind of a really curious, you know, the division between kind of literate and illiterate France. kind of, I suppose, does have a place in conceptions of rural France, but is a kind of a really bizarre kind of thing to hang your hat on as a regionalist, right? I mean, unless it's representing something else. So it's kind of, I suppose I'm just kind of curious, how do people sort of define the region? What kind of things are at work? Is this kind of, you sort of hinted at, you know, ethno-linguistic factors,
sure,
which of course again wouldn't really cohere with that sort of Maggiolo line. Or are institutions important in terms of kind of municipalities and the ways in which political structures influence politics and political rhetoric? I don't know kind of how you would unpack some of those things, right? How region is defined.
Mm. Good question. I think your name is Paletti. I think it's Marie-Claude Paletti who talks about households. And you're right. The Journal de Béziers, like the Echo de Corbière before it, has, I would say, quite a... I mean, it's the South. It is quite a kind of, I think, charitably you'd say, masculinist culture. Uncharitably, chauvinist, effectively, but the Journal de Béziers is like every, you know, Miss Béziers has like a frequent role in these things, and everything is illustrated by stock photos of models, like, and it's all kind of, you know, I think it does seem like there's a kind of very like traditional focus on gender roles. It doesn't seem all pervasive. There are kind of progressive images of women that are given in this journal, for example. There's a female, I can't think of the word, bullfire.
Matador.
Yeah, matador, that's the word. Sorry, I couldn't think of the word. Just that kind of like a bullfighter man. There's a female bullfighter who's like profiled in sort of, what do you say, like, lionized because she talks about a need to defend culture, traditional culture, and of course she's just saying like, let me continue to kill bulls, but he takes that as like, you know, our ethnic identity is under threat from and that becomes the kind of the language that you hang that on. There's also a big focus on the volleyball team in the journal, the Angels of Béziers. They're in like every other issue, seemingly.
Well, that's gone off, is it?
But yeah, that's a kind of certainly an interesting way to see things.
UCL telling you your time's up.
It is, yeah.
I was interested in that heart there because it seems to go across the Spanish border.
Yeah, I,
and of course, Occitan does
so,
go across.
Yes,
the Spanish border.
In response to that bit, I would say that may be reading too much into a rough cartoon. Not because I'm saying you're wrong, but I agree there are kind of like odd references to some of that. But not all of it is in an entirely coherent sense. And many of the people who are strongly involved in the Occitan movement in the past, people like Fabre Colbert, who would have been of that stripe and would have been engaging with a more strong kind of ethno-linguistic identity. And even Yves Roquette, who is profiled in Journal de Béziers as une grande amie de Robert Ménard, you know, and all that kind of stuff. They are just... Yeah, it seems like there is a definition of the region... I don't know, that's making unusual noises. Which is largely one of...
Huh? Yeah. Sorry. We don't need to. Very good point, though. Sorry. There's a definition in the region, which is one which just kind of tries to accentuate a periphery identity, I think. As it's used by Menard, it's used to denote a periphery identity. He makes frequent references to the South as a space of difference from the North. So he constantly talks about the differences of Southern culture, about people being different, people having, you know, hot tempers, brown hair and fiery eyes, like, you know, all this kind of, you know, like romanticised language. There is, of course... obviously, the Journal de Béziers is written in French. All the correspondence to it is in French. Some of the resistance, like at the back page of that, they publish a right of reply bit, and all the kind of opposition, they're mandated to do this, that all the opposition write in to say every week, like, we hate you. And that's the kind of, you know, every week is the same. For a while, one of the communist guys writes in Occitan, which is interesting, but not for very long. I don't know why they just think, like, oh, I'll have a go, and then gives it up. But of course, Occitan continues being... very much a minority language, one which declines in its significance in the region because of kind of, well, all the cultural factors that we know about already, in terms of its kind of spoken usage, its kind of presence in schools, the availability of literature in that language, and especially of public language, you know, in the kind of old, what's it called, imagined community sense of the word, interesting again to see that even some of the politicians are writing in the Journal de Béziers in Occitan, which shows that it's still a kind of an issue, still an idea. And so that definition tends to be. Interestingly, he sets up a big thing about trying to say that, you know, Montpellier, Toulouse, everyone says that's what's going on in the South, everyone says that's where the interest is, the hell with them, let's start a new one, Béziers-Narbonne. Let's get back into Béziers-Narbonne, like big old rugby derbies that we had, let's profile what we did in the 70s, let's say that, like, this is where it's at, you know, and we're going to, like, you know, show them up, as it were. Institutions, interestingly, the agglomération, like the kind of like the regional corporation, effectively, Maynard basically goes to war with them. They're a kind of child of Coudert's mayoralty, and like every issue is just about how they like burn money. And they have like these concocted photos of like this guy. I think it's called Jean Salat is the guy that's the head of it, and it's just like photoshopped him onto stock photos, like throwing money and like, you know, I mean, all this nonsense, or setting money on fire. There's always these kind of things. There's one where there's an open grave that says Coudert, and people are pouring money into it. And, you know, it's just this constant language of waste and all the rest is kind of part of it. But yeah, absolutely. So that can roughly get what you ish, I think it's.
It won't surprise you that I'm interested in the comparison between this and 1907.
Yeah.
Particularly the fact that they launch it with a full blown Catholic mass, and the relationship between Cabrier and Morin in 07, the global elites and anti Semitism, you know, come out of the end of the Dreyfus affair, and here we have global elites. We have Philip de Villiers, a royalist, a monarchist, a Catholic, and Catholic stuff. But you don't talk very much about that.
No,
about that old story.
Yeah.
This is a new story.
Yes. Yeah.
But is there genuinely a comparison? Do they refer back to that?
I think it's part of this big right alliance type idea. This big idea that there are temporary political alliances to advance short-term aims, even though long-term programs may differ. So in the short term, it suits a populist nativist line, which talks about a kind of mass of people who are being somehow manipulated by you know, corrupt elite. It says, actually, there is an identity we need to defend, one which is vulnerable. In this journal, they have pictures of Eric Zemmour made up to look like Asterix. You know, he talks about defending a France, defending the cathedral. They talk about, you know, of course, they've got de Villiers with his, like, you know, the, you know, Defense du Clocher type idea, you know, all that kind of stuff. It becomes about this idea of, like, rooting the local. And so really that vector, I think, is through, it meets in the local. And that's where that idea of roots becomes really important, I think. It's also interesting to see Macron really focus on that idea of roots in that kind of speech from last Thursday, the old Act II malarkey. But that I think, will become interesting, because that's the opposite to what Villar's saying, about this kind of rootlessness. And Villar's most recent book is about this idea of kind of like the crumbling of democracy. And for him, it's about the erosion of civil society. It's about the way that kind of that culture of mobility, that atomization of the individual as a kind of part of, you know, contemporary industrial kind of capitalist society and all the rest of it, has risen and risen. The arrival of cars, the arrival of streaming, like, you know, TV, all that stuff for him kind of slightly erodes this kind of like investiture in civil, and I mean, that's not new, you know. Gordon Brown was saying that, you know. Other people were saying, like, they think we can see this all over the place. But I think,
Well, exactly.
And that's, and interestingly, I put this up because you're all historians, and I think this is quite funny. One of the things that they trumpet as well. Oh, look, one of the books, oh, let's come back up. One of the books that they review exceptionally positively is your man, Neil Ferguson. But also, this one here just gets me in love it. You know, this, car le Britannique s'est exploité les données du temps blanc. Afin de critter le présent, le tout heureusement sans le filtre de l'idéologie. No idea, completely devoid of ideology. Thank God someone's finally telling it straight. And that, I think, is part of it. So I think the way you get somebody like that in the same boat as somebody approving of what Ferguson's saying is through that idea of separate cultures. It's through that idea of a war of civilization, which is the kind of part of that broader platform of the right, which seeks to kind of stoke up, I think, all those ideas.
And so, use all those old tropes as well.
Yeah.
The global elite.
Absolutely.
The ruthlessness.
Absolutely.
And stuff. Even though, actually, that's not a big issue down here, right?
I mean, no, it's not. But then again, they can tap into those same ideas. And, you know, they talk about 1907. Well, they talk about the Albigensian. In 1907, they talk about the Albigensian Crusades as being the barons of the North. And then in 1907, they say it's the new, like, capitalist barons of the North are coming to hurt us. And here, they say, well, it's the new kind of political barons of the North are coming to kind of erode our civilization and, like, impose mixité and all this kind of, like, you know. We know this kind of.
Aren't the Cathars quite problematic for the Catholic Church?
They should be, yeah. They should be, yeah. But at the same time, you have, you know, Maynard take to the stage after a Catholic Mass and say, we are a Christian civilization, like the Cathar perfects. They died here, and we need to acknowledge that. I can't tie it. It doesn't make sense, so I can't really kind of tie it together, if you know what I mean. It relies on it.
I have the same problem with the video, which means a big hero joke about yeah. gets burned by the Catholic Church.
Yes. And what a review for de Villiers as well. You know, that idea of the stunningly contemporary story about how, you know, people is betrayed by its elites. Is that the story of Joan of Arc? I mean, I know it gets kicked about all over the shop under the Vichy regime, but that strikes me as a kind of exceptionally new, odd retelling. And I must admit, I haven't delved into his books. They don't really appeal. But
de Villiers is a royalist.
Yes, yeah.
To be clear about this, if they're bringing that set of ideas to this region, that seems a bit odd.
It is, but then they don't, so they're not in ideological lockstep. So Maynard, for example, tries to get de Villiers to come out in the last election for Le Pen. He says, he goes on the radio in France Inter and says, like, come on, support Le Pen, get on board, we need somebody like you involved in this because this is the project that's going to win. And he doesn't. He does Dupont-Aignan, I think it is. You know, he's just, you know, he picks this kind of odd runner and he says, like, I'm not going to get on board with that. And that's part of this, like, broad platform, this ose ta droite and all this kind of, like, stuff is trying to kind of construct these lines between it. And for some it's too strong, for some it's too little. I think it's, yeah it's about confluence rather than convergence, if you see what I mean.
Okay.
It's maybe the way I'd explain it. Sorry, that was a very long answer to
thanks for the really fascinating paper. I'm stoked to read the thing in print. So I have a couple of questions. You mentioned about wine, obviously about wine, that the Languedoc region produces 35% of wine consumed within France and 5% of...
In the mid-70s, yeah.
In the mid-70s, okay. Yeah. So that partially answers my question. I mean, I guess then, do you have any idea what the figures are currently? Because that would explain... It would help to explain, you know, some of the sort of like... clarify the economics on the ground, especially given the massive amounts of uprootings are going on.
Yeah. The answer to that is, no, I don't have them to hand. I apologise for that. I could find them. The Journal of Wine Economics is pretty good, kind of like giving you the graphs and all the rest of it. And I probably should add that into the paper as a kind of like a coda to say, like, check it out. This is where we are now.
Yeah. My funny meaning is, like, if that remains static, then you presume that the average profitability of any sort of winery is going to skyrocket, given that they're slashed. You know.
Yeah.
Obviously, it seems not to be the case.
France is still a dominant producer, but its place has been reduced because, of course, the one thing we associate with the mid-70s is, of course, things like, you know, 1976 is not only the year that the Crabbe shot a policeman. And one of them is shot by a policeman, by whatever. Like, they kill a policeman, the policeman kills one of them in a kind of, like, shoot-off. But it's also the year of the Judgment of Paris, you know, the birth of the New World, American wine and Australian wine and all the rest of that kind of global market. And the difficulty is, while global production... Sorry. While global consumption kind of is more diversified, so, for example, as North Europeans start drinking much more wine from that period, it's never enough to replace the stuff that goes on in the South. Joseph Bowling has just written a new book on that, which I'm meant to review at the end of next month for Stu, and I'm way into it, by the way. I've read all of it, and I really which I'm planning to read very soon. Sorry, it's always difficult when you talk about review and the review that's sitting in Ireland. That addresses many of those points, and it's because there is a kind of, you know, coordinated campaign anti-vin in France, which, you know, is and which these guys hate and really go on about and all the rest of it. So.
I mean, just a few more questions, Ben. Mm-hmm. It's okay. Like, is there any dialogue about, I mean, this was a region that was exporting huge quantities at some point. Mm-hmm. So is there any, which would be hypocritical but not surprising given these sort of movements, is there any dialogue saying we need to maintain access to, I don't know, the United States or Argentina, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And then this is related. I want to know more about this uprooting. It's really fascinating. Like, mm-hmm. is it a voluntary choice? Are the people, yep. like, is it, like... And what are the economics of it? Is it like a one-time payment to the people? Is it kind of like an ongoing thing? Mm-hmm. Does the money just go to the head of the wine cooperative, or is it then... sort of distributed to the workers?
Cool, yeah. So exports, first of all, they don't export loads and loads and loads and loads because it's vin de consommation courante, and so most of it's just drunk kind of in France, shall we say, but in the region as well. You know what I mean? It's the drinking wine. It's the staple rather than the star of the dinner table, as the kind of the truism would hold.
You have to remember, it was served in primary schools until quite recently.
Yeah.
So, you know, you would get a lunch, isn't it? An 8-year-old and have a glass of wine.
We drip of wine, and it's going to be southern. It'll be Vin du Languedoc. It's not going to be from anywhere. You know, it's real local, or it's going to be that's the bulk producing. They do have exports. I found a really interesting thing. My next project is going to be on the Larzac occupation. I'm looking a lot into stuff about that, and I found a really interesting pamphlet which is written in Germany by the German Friends of Occitania about how to import your own Occitan wine. But it's like evidence of the fact how most key it is. It's like, as an individual, how do you personally import wine? You know, is this kind of like odd thing? But also allows you to show solidarity with a minority region and all the rest of that kind of which is certainly kind of a big thing there. In terms of the prime d'arrachage, you can see here, what usually happens is you are paid a large sum of money to literally physically take the vines from the ground. And you see lots of images of in the newspapers, and sorry, I should have rooted one out, but they take the vines uprooted from the ground, and a lot of the kind of protests involve them literally chucking them all in the back of a truck and then going dumping them right in the middle of the town centre and stuff like that, because then, you know, it's this idea of like, look at what you've made us do. But usually it means you get a payment and then you make a promise not to replant for 5 to 10 years, depending on the precise round. They also have so they do it in coordinated programmes, but then they also have emergency uprooting programmes as well, where they provide more money to do that. And so it's usually, it has to be productive vines. It can't just be like any old, you know, I mean, thing on a roundabout or something like that, you know. It has to be things which are producing those high volume things. And so they are designed to be kind of uprooted. And often the kind of the accusation at the time is that some people are doing this kind of like some like kids, you know, kids, but they inherit the family winery. They don't like the life of the South. They don't want to be farmers. They don't want to be wine growers. They want to go work in Montpellier or Paris or somewhere with a bit of like something about it. Sack it. They just sell it. That doesn't matter to them. Like, they just like sack it off, sell it, and then the place will get sold, be on Airbnb or get sold to somebody from the US, and they'll come in and they'll plant a couple of like, you know, artisan vines and like make it a kind of holiday home sort of thing. And that's the accusation. It becomes a kind of like, people see it as a betrayal, was one of the things we found interesting.
So it's basically a one time payment, I'm gonna read that correctly, to whoever owns the,
I think it's a one time payment, but it can be phased, like in terms of release.
But there's no like obligation to be like, we're gonna pay this to the majority stakeholder or whatever, and then also you have to pay X dollars to the your workers and so on.
Yeah.
Might help explain kind of.
Yeah, so I don't. To my knowledge, it's not anything to do with like seasonal workers and pickers and stuff. Don't get any kind of dividend, you might say. The way cooperatives work is it is usually people that own small parcels of land. The small parcels of land or vines, which are too expensive or too, like the economics don't make sense to be your own kind of winery. So they sell their grapes to a cooperative winery who makes it in big steel vats into the kind of, you know, van de la bibine, and then everybody kind of scooshes at each other, and that's the kind of, that's the fun. So it would kind of, like, the cooperatives themselves kind of lose out because the people that are the smallholders that own the tiny parcel of vines, they just sell up, and it becomes kind of consolidated. That's one of the big things as well. A lot of the kind of the smallholders, and often when somebody's a smallholder, that doesn't mean they just own that small parcel of land and that's it. Often they will own that small parcel of land, they will sell their grapes to a cooperative, but they will also do paid labouring work on other people's vines in bigger places. So it tends to be kind of pluriactivity within the one sector, but it is monoculture in terms of the vine up until 84 is the turning point in terms of the actual movement. But yeah, that's the kind of the factor of it.
Yeah, really interesting feedback.
Excellent, thank you very much.
I was wondering, I really like your quote by Yvonne Claire when he said, oh, well, we only sell like 0.5% of
yeah.
our own wine.
Yeah.
How do you think the protest that you speak about in the like 80s, how do you think that had any impact on supermarkets continuing this kind of like wine, well, French wine protectionism, how they sell? Or do you think that was not selling foreign wine is just really ingrained in people's mentality?
I think it's a bit of both. You know, I mean, like Marine Le Pen talks about how, you know, oh, like we see the socialists, they took on our kind of made in France idea. It's like, yeah, did they hell? Like, it wasn't your idea, let's be honest. But I agree. I think one of the things that comes from that 84 thing is that fire at Leclerc, is the negotiations. They have to negotiate with the FNSEA, which is the kind of like the growing union of the national, like the federation of the national one, you know? And they... essentially, Leclerc said, right, we will only sell the wine of growers who are signed up to this modernising union, the kind of the good guys who believe in improving quality and reducing quantity. We're not going to sell the wine of like the old cooperatives made up of the guys who are the casseurs, who are going to go and like trash things and all the rest of it. So they boycott wine made by certain unions, which encourages the kind of growth of the modernising union, which is part of that greater responsibilisation. It's part of that greater trend towards the improvement of quality and reduction of quantity right across the Languedoc. So in that specific sense, it drives a certain, like the interaction with the supermarket, drives a certain trend of development within the Languedoc Roussillon. However, the actual sales policy, I think, is part of just the continuing prominence of those unions in representing wine growers at a national level. I think they kind of, there's a loud voice to be had. It becomes part of a kind of, you know, it becomes patrimony. It becomes a kind of cheap way to do patrimoine, is this idea of kind of drinking French, I think, in a way that maybe, well, you don't get here, obviously, because we don't produce wine in any meaningful way. I think it's tied to elements of national identity. I think it's also tied to specific syndical developments and the way that certain unions who promoted modernising wineries and improving quality then represented their case at a national level, which drives an association that drinking French is a kind of positive patriotic thing to do in some ways. I don't have the specific kind of platform for the national sales strategy. I think that's the kind of thing I'm going to find out when I read Joe Bowling's book.
And you just mentioned quality, but I wonder whether somewhere in the article you don't want to say something about how, say, newspapers like Le Monde or other, or like, what was the dominant discourse in France, not necessarily from Béziers, but
sure,
in France, about, was anyone saying, well, maybe that's a good thing that they're getting rid of these vines because some of the wine produced around Béziers is of poor quality.
There doesn't seem to be a kind of sneering idea of it. Like it tends to be more just the case of like this is like a big active union, you know, a big kind of active like labour problem, effectively. And so the kind of the narrative that comes from Le Monde is always like they're always en colère, like that's it, like that's what they do. If you know what I mean, in the south, that's the south, and so that's the narrative again. Le Figaro has got a continuing series on them, which is all about, you know, the medium corner, and that's just like again and again. They're just like, oh, here they again, look, check it in. Like we last checked in with our heroes 5 years ago, and here they are again, doing the same thing. You know, one of the guys has changed. You know, is that kind of like the way that it gets reported in the national press is almost this like eternal return. You can always count on something. You know, you can always count on the bells in the church to ring. You can always count on like a beautiful spring morning. You can always count on somebody be setting fire some tires in the middle of a road in the south and smashing bottles of foreign wine. It's this that plays into the narrative. So I don't know if there's really a commentary on that. They seem to be get depicted as essentially dinosaurs because of that, as kind of relics, and that tends to be the language of Le Monde and Le Figaro certainly. When they get covered in Libération, it tends to be more about the idea of like resistance. They're being pushed out, you know, like you tend to see them like a much more sympathetic eye when people on the left look at it, because it's rural protest, because it's seen as being kind of the cri du peuple, you know, this idea of like something, I don't know, a bit different.
Maybe you could link that with the like the point that you were making on regional, yeah, changing regional identity, happening at the local level, but the continuity of more like the continuity of national discourses about these regional missiles.
Yeah.
But also when you look at the more local and supranational level, then you see how things are changing, and maybe that's how you're nuancing. I don't know.
Yeah. No. You're absolutely. Yeah. No, that's a really good point. I think you're absolutely right. There's a really interesting point in 2005, when there was a big crisis, again, it's part of this endless cycle of crises I describe, when the Bordelais growers as well are also out in protest. And there's a big criticism in the south that the guys in Bordeaux aren't, like, keeping their end up and protesting for everyone. They're sort of just saying, like, just us. The guys in the south are trash. Like, we're not interested. And there's a big kind of accusation that the Bordelais are twirling their moustaches while the entire French wine industry burns. And they're only interested in their one small sector. And so there's no solidarity or anything like that. And there's a real kind of, like, there is inter-regional rivalry, I think you would say, in between those movements in 2005.
Regional stereotypes, because
yeah, of course.
Say, like,
yeah.
Our people in Bordeaux, they're a bit like, you know, they keep themselves to
themselves. Yeah.
That then kind of spread to also corporations, including...
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I would absolutely agree. Even in 1907, you know, 1907, Grand Révolte du Midi, 1911, in the Champagne, and you don't really see, like, much kind of interplay, again, because there's different discourses about the way that wine is produced and what the wine means and how it's sold, how it's consumed, all that kind of stuff, even if it's a developmental discourse in terms of Champagne, as you can, you know, see in some, like, Colin Guy's work. But again, you know, it's part of that same odd understanding.
Thank you for the paper. You mentioned earlier about the Judgment of Paris,
mm-hmm.
sort of the
yep.
emergence of like New World
sure.
Wine. And I'm wondering about what role that plays here. I'm thinking about a couple of things. I don't know if you're familiar with the film Mondo Vino.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. And of course, in that film, they have the village that is resisting
yeah.
the purchase of a vineyard by. Right, by law.
It's
been a while since I've seen it.
Aimé Guibert.
Right. And the large California producer
sure.
once
yeah.
is coming in. And then also you mentioned they've used the image of the guy with the Coca-Cola.
Mm.
And that echoes an earlier campaign, right, in the 40s and 50s of the Communist Party.
Sure, and Kaiser stuff. Absolutely.
To prohibit
Coca-Cola
as a threat to the wine industry.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if is that something that sort of returns in this period? More sort of protest on
women. Yeah, they do, actually. You're absolutely right. Yeah, it's a really good point. They have some stuff where they really they play a lot. I've got one of my, I think my Twitter header image is the old kind of stuff they have in reference to Pasteur, where he claims that wine is the most kind of clean and hygienic of beverages and it's the best thing to drink. And of course, you know, it's all this stuff. The Crave come out and like people talk about them having posters where they show like, you know, why would you drink water? And they show like a river and somebody pissing in a river. And then like they have on the other hand, like clean wine, lovely wine, hygienic wine. Now that's what you want to get. You know, and like, a lot of it's tongue in cheek around these kind of discourses, but they constantly criticize the campaign anti-vin, and they're always kind of railing against this idea that people hate wine, that actually that there's no problem with wine, the problem's always like hard liquor and all the rest of it, wine's a good thing for you, you know, they cite all these things, and it's part of this kind of returning idea. You get lots of moments where actually people are kind of railing against kind of foreign imports, railing against New World wines from you know, whether it be Chile, Greece, whether it be, you know, Greece is an old, new world wines, but, you know, I mean, new imports as part of, like, European economic, you know. But then they kind of, like, any kind of increase in imports from somewhere else, they describe in the most alacritous terms. A guy called André Kez talks about how each tanker of imported wine that sails up the Canal du Midi is a bomb aimed at the heart of the Midi Viticole and all this kind of stuff. It's you know, it's held up as being invasive, like an invasive species, if you know what I mean. And so they do constantly just hold it up. And that's part of this narrative. What can we do in the face of global capitalism, you know, European things and all this kind of stuff? We want to stand up for this, which is why during the 70s, that idea of, you know, volem vivere al pais, we want to live and work on our land, is so compelling. Because all these people are saying is, like, essentially we want, I mean, to look at it negatively, we want the right to indolence, if you know what I mean. We want to kind of, like, to stay here and just do what we're doing and leave us alone, get off my lawn, effectively, is the kind of the message that comes out of the movement. But that comes with, like, not just that, but it also comes with, like, cultural ideas of language, of identity, and all the other kind of, like, the ideas of difference. But that's why that's so vulnerable, to be weaponized by the right, to be weaponized by someone who is kind of harking back to the, you know, like France Profonde, which talks about the kind of organicist vision of a kind of nationalist France at the same time. And it kind of mixes up these languages. Because whereas in the 70s and 80s, it's very much all of the left. And all the Occitanistes are there at Larzac, they're all there with the PSU, you know, they're all there with, like, the kind of all the kind of radical left visions of, you know, difference. But then as soon as the PC, the PS get into to power under Mitterrand, suddenly they can't claim to be kind of completely different. They can't claim to be unmoved. They can't claim to do all these things because, like, actually, you know, like, where is your change? Where is your all the rest of it? And that kind of starts this, like, big, like, shift. Segue. It's also why you see the development of protests like how it develops into other things. So again, wine growers blocking toll booths in 2017. It's why a lot of these things suddenly play into the language of what happens in 2018, 2019. It's why you start to see the emergence of the Gilets jaunes, especially from a similar type of narrative. It plays upon the same narrative. It's ways in which you see it. You see a lot of blogs written around Béziers, which talk about the 17th you know, regiment. It talks about 1907 in the same context. It says, you know, the CRS are here firing things, harming protesters. That's why they sit down and say, you know, it's the kind of the suicide by cop thing they're trying to kind of get at as well. They're saying, like, our brothers in 1907 didn't shoot us, so be the same guys and all the rest of it. And of course, you know, that's the kind of thing that puts up here. You can see the same kind of language around it as well. Just leave us alone is the idea. We just want to live. We just want to kind of be here and make a living out of our vines. And of course, it's the same thing that allows people like Robert Ménard to simultaneously be the mayor of Béziers, but likewise go out amongst the Gilets jaunes and say other people don't come here. Other kind of, like, you know, Elu, don't walk amongst you, like, I'm listening, I'm here. Then they hold, of course, that's the front page, you can see in February 2019, Le Cri du Peuple, Grand Débat. They hold their own Grand Débat in Béziers, which is televised, and Ménard kind of hosts it and all the rest of it. And he says, this is all Macron. And very quickly after that, you start to see these images of, like, Macron, like, with his head photoshopped onto the devil and all this kind of stuff. So it's part of the same language. And that plays upon that same kind of, like, flexible narrative of regional resistance while playing upon those same underlying demographic shifts that people like Jean Villard describe, of kind of, you know, the peripherization of France, the suburbanization of France, the peri-urbanization of France, the same kind of, like, idea of something quite different, I think, of the losers of globalization, of the places that don't do so well. There's a reason that this narrative exists in Béziers more than it does in Montpellier, for example, of what comes from somebody like Ménard, you know, I think.
Just wanted to ask about how the CRAV engage with the Front National, and its utilisation of regionalists and wine growing trips. I mean, you spoke about kind of the issue of kind of confluence between various different actors on the right, and the kind of willingness to kind of share certain political territory because it's in all of their interests, even if they don't necessarily kind of want exactly. But what about something like CRAV, which comes from a radically different tradition, and yet its language is effectively being utilised by, I mean, is there any kind of engagement between the two organisations?
Not so much, because after 92, they disappear as a functional voice in the politics of the region. They become masked They are increasingly seen as people that wear balaclavas. They are increasingly less accountable. Throughout the 70s and 80s, even into the early 90s, there's always a porte-parole du crave. You know, there's always one guy who notionally isn't there, you know, like mixing it with the cops. He's the guy that kind of like, you know, just speaks to them and then like conveys them as like a, you know, as their spokesman. And that's people like, you know, yeah, like the people I talked about already, Jean Bouillet, people like André Caz, like people that I talk about in the book, you know. But from the 90s, they don't really have that anymore. The closest you get is probably someone like Frédéric Cluanet, but he still maintains a distance from the right. But again, he is Oudois, and like there's less of a kind of right stronghold, I think, in the Oud than there is in the Echo. But yeah, he's kind of part of that same kind of thing. So notionally, there's less of a coherent message that comes from that constituency. So there's less opportunity for them to engage with it. I think undeniably, there must be members that vote FN, that go out and do the kind of wine commando stuff, because it just makes sense, if you know what I mean. They seem like the guys that would, in some ways. But undoubtedly, there are many who don't. But there's no really meaningful way to do it. Again, as I found often, you struggle to speak to people involved in it because, again, they're involved in criminal activity. They don't want to talk to you and give you their name and say, like, oh, yeah, quote me in an article or whatever. Like, because they don't, you know, they'll say, oh, my mate did this or my mate did that. I'm like, oh, I know a guy who's in the craft. And, you know, you never get to the bottom of these things and they never want to express that. So it's tough to find a coherent message.
And the reverse of that, did the Front National ever kind of reference them, or it strikes me that they kind of, on the one hand, they'd be keen to kind of, I mean, they're clearly using these kind of regionalist and wine interests, but at the same time, the kind of authoritarian kind of policing.
Absolutely. Securitized rhetoric, like, it's anti that. Yeah,
it
sounds
like it was really not.
Now, for somebody like Ménard, that's what it's close as you get. This like page in the Journal de Béziers, which comes up saying like we must support the wine growers of the Midi in their campaign against Spanish wine, and like the idea that they're attacking these kind of, you know, grand surface and the kind of in the suburbs is like he hates the grand surface. I don't think he likes the bombs or the fires or anything like that. You know what I mean? But he likes people doing away with the big chain stores, which he thinks kill and throttle the kind of like small stores in the centre of town, like the one that sells exclusively plastic ducks in the centre of Béziers. That gets like several pages coverage in the Journal de Béziers. Yeah, this is about as close as they get, like this kind of like full page thing in the Journal de Béziers. But this shows you also what they're complaining about as well. So like this on the one hand is the Fontaine, the wine boxes. You just call them that, yeah? And this is a French one, Pays d'Oc. This one here is Spanish wine. And the whole thing they point out is they call it fraud because they say, like, how's a consumer meant to know that this is not French? It has like French names on it, it has French words on it, it has like traditional rural French imagery on it, it'll often have kind of French peasants on it. Like all the stuff is badged up as being kind of patrimonially French, but it's Spanish. And it's just, you know, boxed or up by the French people. So that's the kind of, you know, that the closest you get is this kind of stuff here where they say, like, essentially, yeah, we support the wine growers, but they never support the crave because you can't really support the crave because all they do is set fire to stuff. So you can't, unless you're a kind of like complete oddball, you can't really get on board.
What's the thing in the background?
Spanish flag.
Behind a crown with a lion or something?
Yeah, it's a Spanish flag, the Castilian crest.
Spanish
flag, yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just the Castilian crest.
Okay.
I don't know who this guy is. I think he's just a stock photo. Like, they are like frequent abusers of stock photos, is what I would say. You know, all the ones you see, like, who would ever use that? Robert Ménard at his Odd magazine is the one who would use it. I have to say, I sat and read 93 issues of this kind of municipal publication to get to the heart of this, and this only appeared in number 58. So it took a lot of digging to get through it. It's 36 pages long, but yeah.
36 pages.
36 pages each issue, yeah.
All right, well, you'll tell us about it in the pub then.
Yes, indeed. Let's go for a drink.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Thank you
very much.
The
next person.